now.
It's back to Refilwe Mpakanyane
on 702.
It's 6:35 on the Sunday edition of Weekend Breakfast. I just got a message asking, how is the app spelled? How's the name of the app spelled? And yes, it is Panda, P-A-N-D-A, as in the animal. So go and check it out. And I guess on the back of my conversation about the launch of this app, this mental health support app, how do you, have you ever struggled before? Have you struggled in the past to access mental health services? And were you dealing with the sort of fear around walking into a center, walking into a group session, or just having to sit in front of someone that you'd never met before and opening up or saying, I need help? Right? How much of a barrier was that for you to accessing health? Not to mention the actual cost of it all, right? The cost of seeing a psychiatrist or a psychologist in person is obviously a huge, huge barrier to entry for far too many South Africans. But how did you overcome that? And I guess, the periods, the difficulties that actually accessing help and seeking help have gotten you through. I remember being a junior producer, highly overworked, highly stressed. And as my guest in that conversation, Alan Sweden, was saying, it's a Sunday and you're going to work on Monday and you just get the blues. You are freaked out. You're anticipating all the worst things the next day and in the week to come. And yeah, it helps to talk to someone who will just let you know that, you know what, you're not the only one experiencing this. And perhaps, of course, you might actually be creating extra scenarios in your head that aren't necessarily going to, be realized. So just helping you put things in perspective, and also helping you put things in perspective such as what is in your control and actually how can you impact or affect the situation. That's, the kind of sort of common sense approach that you can often get from speaking and reaching out to someone. Of course, not to mention actual diagnosis and actual, medical and professional interventions. But yeah, give me a sense of the kind of journey you've had in accessing mental health care. And, if this might have made your life much easier to be able to click on an app and send a message or join an anonymous audio group. I imagine it definitely could have or would have helped so many people had this come about much sooner. But yeah, let's keep on having that conversation about mental health care or mental health wellness matters. It's really, really key and important. Very, very shortly, we're going to be discussing biodiversity and, of course, the key role, the very, very important role that citizen scientists play in all of this. It's 6:38.
Weekend Breakfast with Refilwe Mpakanyane
on 702.
It is a Sunday, and it being a Sunday, we talk Nature Diary with Tim Neary. Of course, he's our resident CSI and conservation expert. And as per usual, I imagine, Tim, good morning, first of all. I imagine you're standing out in the garden and surveying your friends, your neighbors, and your cohabitants. What are they up to today?
Yeah, I'm surveying everything, including Bum and Dumber, who are the two local chickens who have appeared.
Aww.
They are not the brightest pennies in the bush, that's for sure. I'm quite surprised they actually got to lay eggs at some stage of their life. They are rescue chickens, but let me tell you that they've been here about a month, mm-hmm. 6 weeks. Snails under control, of all sorts of bugs and beetles. And to watch the way their eyes work, they'll suddenly scuttle across the lawn at 100 miles an hour and you wonder what's going on, and then they tuck into some poor bug that has just settled down onto a plant that is about to, sort of have a little bit of food. But it's quite amazing how that, as I suppose you could call it a biological control, mm-hmm. a natural control of your garden, how well it works.
Well, speaking of Dumb and Dumber and natural controls, there's a rooster somewhere in my neighborhood that needs to be naturally controlled, preferably by being turned into a chicken Potos. And mushroom pie. This guy does not mind crowing at 1 a.m., midnight, 2 a.m., long before there's even a hint of sunrise. It is the most upsetting thing. And I think he's kind of in tune with when people are at their most stressed or need to wake up super early. This is what this rooster is doing to us.
Yeah, he's massively got a mate who's a hardy dog sitting in a high tree, and they set each other off. But yeah, no, it's fun watching at the moment because, of course, everybody's nesting, and we've had a few little chicks going, frantically. But the speed that some of the things like doves, the speed at which they breed is quite fascinating.
Yeah.
And I see that my odd plover is back down in the park when I've walked past a few times. It's a lapwingers, I'm told they're called.
Mm-hmm.
But it's two species that have crossed, and every year they produce a chicken, they bring it up. It fascinates me.
Lovely stuff.
And the bat work at the moment, I mean, for anybody that goes out walking at night now with the just after the rain, and we've had those flying ants out.
Mm.
Oh, the other night, I guess there must have been 100, 200 bats around the street lamp, and they were just having the most wonderful time chomping on flying ants. It was wonderful to see.
It's a gorgeous time of year, isn't it? It really, really is. I mean, just over the last 2 weeks, having seen the growth, the emergence of, just this new life and just, the changing landscape, the greening of the landscape, you feel like a new person. And, of course, new life all
absolutely.
Around. It's gorgeous.
And I think to watch the bats as well, which I find very interesting, is there's a chair, a bench in the park, and I like to sit on that with the binoculars and watch them come out. And you've got those very tall palm trees that are quite riffly at the top,
mm-hmm.
and the bats live in those. And, of course, they just fall out,
because
bats can't sort of flap their wings and take off. And somebody asked that question the other day, if we find a bat on the ground, what do you do? Well, you've got to get it upwards. You either try and get it onto a pencil or whatever so that it can actually flop down and go off, because bats can't take off from the ground. That's not their natural world.
I feel as though I ought to have known that, Tim. But this is why we have the Nature Diary, isn't it?
Exactly. There we go. Excuse me while I have another sip of my coffee.
Fabulous. Job well done. We can end the conversation right here. All right, fantastic stuff. But of course, the reason we are here today is to talk about something rather interesting, and I think a term or a phrase that you've dropped quite a number of times in our conversations is citizen scientists. And today the focus is citizen scientists and the role that they can play in biodiversity. So the conversation, joining us for this conversation, is Professor Les Underhill, who's head of the Biodiversity and Development Institute, as well as a retired professor from the University of Cape Town Statistics. Welcome to Weekend Breakfast, Prof. Thank you so much for your time. Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks, Shafiri, for inviting me. I appreciate it.
An absolute pleasure. Of course, this has everything to do with Tim Neary inviting you on. Tim, let's talk about why we've got the Prof on the line today, and specifically his angle into biodiversity and what the ordinary person can do.
Well, I think, I'm rather keen to find out. He went off to the tundra 30-odd years ago, and this has changed the aspect of where he was going and what his research work was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I enjoy is that by normality, professors or academics, let's call it academics, they tend to be very based on facts and figures and numbers, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And the citizen science, the person who may have just had an interest in science and yet had a huge amount of information that they've collected over the years, always was felt to one side. You never felt part of science.
Mm-hmm.
And I think through people, the work that Les has done and the work that he still does, and the approach has brought the value of the citizen scientist back in. And of course, what is a citizen scientist? And I'm pretty sure that a lot of people listening are in fact citizen scientists without realizing it.
Absolutely. Prof Les, what is a citizen scientist? And do you consider yourself one and a champion of them?
Yes, so I'm a statistician by training. So I'm not a sort of biologist initially. So I guess all the science I do is really, all the biology I do is really citizen science, and that's the perspective, that's the angle that I think I have on science in its entirety, or at least in biology in its entirety. So I consider myself desperately lucky in my life to be able to combine the statistical skills I learnt as a undergraduate and postgraduate, combine those with application in the sort of the big data that we collect through citizen science.
Liz, you mentioned in one of your discussions, etc., that going off to the tundra changed your aspect and your thought process. First of all, what was the trip to the tundra? And secondly, how did it change how you viewed the need of citizen science, etc.?
Yeah, so we're talking about 1980s, 1990s, when the Soviet Union was still the Soviet Union, or Russia was still the Soviet Union. And I was part of Western Cape Wader Study Group, which we ringed waders at Langebaan Lagoon. We were the first successful group in the Southern Hemisphere. And I was the sort of ringer in the group, and I was a statistician. So the guys gave me the data to analyze. And that, in a sense, was the start of it, just getting involved in that data analysis. And it turned out that these papers that we wrote didn't go unnoticed in Moscow. And so by quirk of events, I was the person who got the invitation to join this trip to the tundra, 1991. And the reason why that trip changed the direction of my life was that it was so much fun. It was hard work, but it was fun. And so a statistician is supposed to spend his or her life sitting in the office waiting for people to bring data. But then I realized that on that trip that biologists have far more fun actually going out, into nature, collecting the data itself. So that was part of what really changed the direction of my life. I realized I learned a lot on that trip in terms of fieldwork skills, and I said to myself, "Gosh, I can do this." So a couple of years later, the Apollo C oil spill came along, and I got deeply involved with that, and deeply involved with a student who came from the UK and did his PhD on the analysis of that data. And so I spent a lot of time on the islands actually looking at penguins, and it developed from there. So, yes, Rhea Button, who wrote that article, she was perfectly right in picking up that trip to the tundra was kind of pivotal in changing the direction of my life.
Yeah. So, Prof, that changed the direction of your life. And I read that before long, you did launch an avian demography unit. But I do wonder, when we talk about citizen science, scientists, and the person who is collecting information, and maybe it's all rather anecdotal, they're making some kind of observations or they're collecting data. What do you know, if they aren't going to set up their own units such as yourself and don't necessarily have, aren't statisticians and don't have that technical know-how and expertise, how do you recommend that they put their scientific, where do they plug in that scientific contributions and who, with whom?
Yeah, I think that if you participate as a citizen scientist in a project, any sort of project, and you aren't, as the citizen scientist, I think, expected to collate the data, do the analysis yourself. I think what the question that you need to ask is, are the people just building a massive database, or are they actually going to put that database, make it work, and use it to influence policy, provide examples for education and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so I have a PhD student at the moment who's actually asking the question, what is the impact of actually participating in citizen science? What is its impact on the participants themselves? And I think the what we've realized is that citizen scientists are not eyes on matchsticks, just collecting data for the scientists.
Mm-hmm.
They are you're deeply impacted by your involvement in seeing change and just grasping the importance of biodiversity to our very existence. The sort of things that Tim was talking about a few minutes ago, like seeing the bats emerging from the trees and that they can't take off the ground.
Yes.
Those are all sorts of insights that you get through participation in these projects. So that, we see that as really, really important, is actually the impact of participation on the people who participate.
Mm. Go ahead, Tim.
Liz, you mentioned the word biodiversity fairly often. How important is biodiversity versus a singular species, for example, project where somebody wants to save the lesser spotted grebe? How important is the understanding of biodiversity? And in fact, can you give us a brief as to what we mean when we say biodiversity?
Yeah, so one of the things that's really important is I think a grasp that our very existence depends on biodiversity. So the air we breathe, most of our crops or many of our crops are actually pollinated by bees, and and to some extent, you can assist that process by importing hives into your vineyards and orchards, but if we can just actually keep all those ecosystem services intact, then it's simply just crucial for our very existence. It's not just a nice to have; it's something which we need to have. And pollination in particular is a critically important ecosystem service, which is provided by biodiversity, and not just by the bees, but having the whole system intact. And so that's why biodiversity is actually so important.
Looking at some of the projects that you've had success with, the one that comes to mind here is the oyster catcher. Have you changed through utilizing citizen science, utilizing the data gathered, etc.? How has the world of the oyster catcher changed?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we've grasped is that through the various oyster catcher projects, we've grasped that oyster catchers have actually done amazingly well. African oyster catchers done amazingly well. A species that was thought to be, on its way to being extinct, to just, not having enough breeding success due to disturbance on beaches and things like that.
Mm.
But first of all, the awareness was created. The beach banding drive made an enormous contribution. But the oyster catcher is an amazing example, because it's a species that has benefited through an invasion with an alien mussel. So we really don't like aliens, and the alien mussel hasn't done our shorelines any favors. But it's provided an enormous amount of food for the oyster catchers. So the oyster catchers are doing better than they've ever done before. So the mussel, the alien mussel, the Mediterranean mussel,
mm-hmm.
came in from the from northern hemisphere on the with the seawater that's put into the tanks of oil carriers when they come south to Saldanha Bay to load up oil. And just before they get to Saldanha Bay, they pump all the water out, and this water contained the larvae of the mussels and got them started on the coast in that Saldanha region, and now they've expanded north all the way up the West Coast, and they expanded as far east as beyond the Eastern Cape. And and it's an awareness of the impact of this alien mussel, which has actually changed how ballast water, as it's called, changed the way that it is managed on tankers. So they're trying to avoid introducing marine organisms on coasts around the world through that. So the citizen science involvement in that story might have been quite small, but it was part of the realization of just how well oyster catchers were suddenly doing and finding an explanation for it. And the alien mussel turned out to be that explanation, besides contributions like the ban on beach driving. It was a whole combination of factors, and it's hard to disentangle them.
Advice to anyone listening who thinks they've got, you know, something useful to contribute to science in general, either by way of data, either by way of expertise in their own area that to this point they thought, you know, wasn't relevant. But your advice to anyone listening?
Well, I think is just to get involved. There are an enormous number of citizen science projects out there, some run by Sandy, some run by ourselves, the Virtual Museum. And you just get on the website. You can Google Virtual Museum, and we would, you know, happily help people get started. So it's a photograph of a bird or a butterfly or something like that, and you don't have to know what it is. You just upload it onto the into the Virtual Museum. It's called the Virtual Museum because a real museum, what you see on the shelf, on the display, is actually mm-hmm. a tiny fraction. And you go behind the scenes, and it's full of shelves of insects and things in the claws. And so we create that on the computer. So it's a virtual museum. So we have millions of records of species, and we use them to produce distribution maps and to see how those distributions are changing through time, mainly as a result of development and of climate change.
Fascinating. Tim, final word.
Yeah, I think, you know, that is the most important thing that Les has just said there, is get involved, get hold of places like the Virtual Museum, look up Biodiversity, the BDI Institute, and that way you can partake, you can share your information. And it's also a lot of really interesting things, as Les says, how things are moving. Where are the scorpions moving in the country? Where are butterflies? It's all the data that goes back in there. And I think that once you have an interest in your garden and you start to see strange creatures and you take a photograph of a hawk moth, for example, upload it. It might be a new area where somebody is now seeing that creature for the first time.
Yeah.
And that's where you become suddenly that citizen science, you participating. And again, there are details on all these places where people can get hold of the likes of Les and email them and say, look, I've got 30 years of collecting data on puff adders. What do I do with it? And, you know, it's amazing. I have a friend of mine who's got years and years of collecting data of leopards in the Magaliesberg. It's all incredibly valuable to science and, of course, just as an interest as well.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Prof. Les Underhill, head of Biodiversity and Development Institute and retired professor of statistics at UCT. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolute pleasure. Tim, always bring us fascinating conversations. I really do look forward to next week's topic. And you keep safe until then.
We will do. And maybe we'll even get Dumb and Dumber to be interviewed on a conversation.
If I track down that naughty rooster, I am donating him to you.
No, thank you. Pot roast.
Don't tell my neighbor.
Pot roast.
Thanks so much to Miri, of course, at CSI Nature Conservationist, bringing us the Nature Diary every Sunday morning just after the 6:30 sports update. If there's any topic that you'd like to suggest for Tim Neary to unpack, to take a look at, do drop me an email, rufilwe@702.co.za.